your host, Patty Kostelic, on the Home Fires Radio Show. This evening, I have a wonderful group of guests. Special recognition of Women's History Week. Not that my guests are historic, but they have certainly contributed to the history of Alaska. I think what I'm going to do is just introduce them by name, and then for my first question, I'm going to ask them to tell us how they met each other. With me in the studio are Florence Weber, Nancy Baker, Ginny Woods, and Celia Hunter, and all of these women have been pilots for a considerable length of time. Would you like to start, Nancy, and tell us how you met each other?
Well,
your version of it, at least.
I probably have people butting in here because...
That's good. Everyone has their own version, right. I'm sure.
My first year in Alaska was 1950, and I came up with Ginny and Celia, who had previously been up here, in order to go out and help them run the roadhouse at Kotzebue, Alaska. And during the summer, we had lots of people would stop in, and Florence, the two Florences we called them at the time, Florence Weber and Florence Collin, who's not here tonight, flew in with your own airplane, didn't you? You guys were visitors,
yeah,
there, and it's really strange when you look back. When you meet people, you know, all of us meet new people every day. You're never sure whether it's going to be somebody you're going to know 20, 30, 40, 50 years from now, or whether it's somebody you'll never see again. But anyhow, they flew in, and they were geologizing, I'm sure, and looking around Alaska. You were working for...
We were working for federal government, U.S. Geological Survey.
They were geologists. Sometime you had worked for an oil company, I guess, in Texas.
Yes, that's right.
So anyhow, you came up, pal, and we met you running up and down the beach at Kotzebue. You're staying at the hotel or something, rather?
Yeah.
You stayed at the hotel where we were, all three of us.
Oh, I'm sure we put you up.
That's right.
Yeah, we put up special people. I was new then. Ginny and Steve, of course, took it. But we met a lot of interesting people that way. I mean, people that we've known for years.
See, what year was it?
1950. Mm-hmm. I'm sure it was 1950.
Yes.
That's
it?
After I left.
Was it?
Well, I went out to get married. You took my place.
That's right, yeah.
You left in July.
Yeah, I didn't tell Weens that I was going to do this. Yeah. And so we had to find a replacement. And we picked you up in the airport at Palm Springs. You were bored with Palm Springs. Yeah. We said, we have a place for you, Alaska. Maybe you'd like to tell them what it was like when we flew you into Kotzebue.
Oh, Lordy. When I flew into Kotzebue, it was, May? Something like that?
May.
Something like that.
Yeah. Pack ice was just...
And I remember this long trip over in the DC-3, and we stopped at Galena. Maybe we made two stops. Maybe it was Nome somewhere. A fantastic meal that the Weens crew had for us. And I met new people. Everything was so new to me. I was from New York, by the way. I was real... Best thing when you're stupid is being from the East Coast, you just keep your mouth shut. Everything is so new. But anyhow, when we took off, to answer your question there, and went into Kotzebue, I guess part of the time I might have been sleeping a little bit and wake up, and I looked down out of that airplane, and all I saw was icebergs, chunks of ice, and I didn't think we were 2 feet off of them. And I guess I really wasn't wrong.
I said, one of those black things, and I said, they're seals. She said, that's what I thought. She said, is there any way I can come home without flying?
Yeah, she said, when's the next boat?
And the plane had to climb about 10 feet to land.
To land, yeah. But these were things that you don't do that kind of flying anymore.
But we never
see your pants flying.
These were the early days when they landed. You might tell when you were in a DC-3 coming from Kotzebue to Nome, working for Weens.
Oh yeah, well, we had pilots like old Freddie Goodwin and Dick King, and these are really the greats of Ween Airlines. They'd been service pilots during the war, and then came up and were flying
pilots before they got on twin engines.
Yes, and they were flying these DC-3s, and
they were cubs.
they flew like pursuits sometimes. Anyway, we had this one trip, and we were flying over Shishmaref, and the pilot said, "Hey, you'd like to go down there?" I said, sure, they'd love it. So all of a sudden, he just wheeled the DC-3 over, and we landed on the beach in front of the trading post at Shishmaref.
That was a DC-3 at that time was a passenger plane. That's what Pan American flew.
The biggest.
Yeah, that's biggest what Pan American flew for airlines into a Fairbanks.
I can also remember some hairy trips, because at that time, during 49 and 50, we used to fly out over the Diomede Islands. And in fact, we used to fly down between the two Diomede Islands along the international date line. Of course, you're not allowed anywhere near there now.
And that's a distance of only 2 miles. Right?
Yes, yeah. That's right. And I can remember the pilots got really competitive about being sure that the passengers would see the Diomedes. And I can remember this one trip we were going out, and we were about 75 feet off the waves. And it was absolutely, the visibility was about a mile. And he just kept boring ahead, and I knew that, the Little Diomede Island was higher than 100 feet. And I kept saying, well, no, really, it's not necessary. We'll be all right. They don't have to see it this time. I was standing behind the pilots, peering out and looking down at those waves and looking out ahead and wondering when we were going to find a stuffed cloud.
Well, you might interject that this was the start of Ween Airlines' trips to Kotzebue. You know, it wasn't scheduled. There was nothing. It was all happened because we happened to go to Kotzebue once and say what a neat place it was. This was when we were just flying cargo in, and we came back to Fairbanks and told everybody what a neat place it was, this Eskimo village. There wasn't any scheduled airlines or not. And so that summer, they decided to see if they could charter a plane, and would we fly it? By the time they got through, there were so many people that we chartered a DC-3, just a regular Doug, and the Ween pilots flew it. But then we'd go along to be hostesses or help fly the plane or take care of them after they got. We'd have to find places for them to stay in Kotzebue and know them when we landed. But that's how what she's talking about.
Fairly extensive job.
Yeah, and these tourist passengers, you got to realize, were sitting in bucket seats. And we were the hostesses, and we'd sit in the back on top of the laundry and make peanut butter sandwiches for them for
budget. Okay, let me start. I'm talking with Tini Woods now. How did you first come to Alaska?
Well, do you really want to know?
Yes.
This is the reason. It's because this picture on the paper of the Weekender and the Newsminer, there's a picture of a...
This is today's paper.
Today's, yes, and it's a picture of with a Russian star on it, and it's a P-63. Mm-hmm. We call them Bell booby traps. And during
Longfuse booby traps.
Yeah. During the war, Sia and I and Nancy were flying for the Women's Air Force Service pilots. We were ferry pilots, and we flew these things it was the Army Air Corps then, and we would pick up these fighter planes and deliver them all over the United States to places of embarkation. They didn't have enough gas in them to go fly them overseas, but the Russian ones, and there were a lot of them, we'd pick up in...
Great Falls.
Buffalo. Yeah, we built and Bell aircraft, and they would be flown to Great Falls, and then the American pilots or the Russian pilots would take them up to Fairbanks, and we'd have to turn these airplanes that we put the first 10 hours on after they got out of the factory, and we had to make a test flight on, you know, keep track of the engine instruments and have a written thing of what it was doing, and then we had to leave them in Great Falls, and because there weren't facilities for women along the route up to Fairbanks. So after the war was over, C and I were offered the job to fly two beat-up old surplus Army planes that weren't even flyable and up to Fairbanks. And we took the offer because, by gum, we were going to see Fairbanks. And it took us 27 days from Seattle to Fairbanks in January of 1946. December. December of 1946.
We left on December 6th and got to Fairbanks on January 1st, 1947.
Right. What were you doing for 27 days?
On the ground waiting for the weather to clear.
Sure. One of the worst winters that they've ever had here. There were 3 weeks, three times that there was 3 weeks at a time. It'd be 50 below zero or colder here in Fairbanks.
And you weren't flying instruments, were you?
Oh, no.
Well, we didn't have enough instruments to fly by. It didn't work. In fact, we only had one radio between us. One of us could send and one could receive.
And the other thing was, Ginny had an airplane that had lots of holes and no heat. We called it Little Eagle.
We stopped at all the places now along the Alaska Highway, mm-hmm. including...
Kimberly Dawson, Breese first.
Yeah, well, then Dawson Creek, and then...
Calgary and Edmonton, Fort Nelson
and Whitehorse.
Watson Lake.
But all those stops that we've heard about during the war. But every time we stopped, it would either be too cold to get the plane started or else there'd be a blizzard coming in. So that's why it took
Besides, we only had about 3 or 4 hours of daylight to fly.
Yeah, that's right. It was the shortest day of the year. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's how we got to Fairbanks. And once we got here, it went to 60 below. It was 3 weeks before Pan Am could come in to take anybody out. In the meantime, we got offered a chance to fly some planes over to Kotzebue with cargo. And we wanted to see Kotzebue. And by the time we got back from that trip, it was starting to be spring. It was like today. And we thought, well, gee, we've been seeing the winter. Let's see what the summer's like. And that's how we didn't plan to stay.
This is perhaps a digression back. When did the... U.S. Armed Services first have women pilots?
Well, they started right after we got in the war of training the first group because they realized that they didn't know how long...
Before they got in the war.
All right, well, let's talk about training.
That was different.
Yeah, let's start about the WASP. They were looking for pilots to ferry airplanes because all the manpower needed to be upgraded as fast as possible and put into combat situations. They didn't have many pilots, and we didn't have a standing military. We didn't have a draft. And so they decided that they would see as experimental how many potential pilots they had with women. So they took first, you had to have about 200 hours to get in and a commercial license, which most of us had. And then after that, they kept lowering it till I think it was a 2-year training program. But the first of it, we were all in the first five classes they had. And we were sent, our group were all sent mostly to the ferry command. But after that, they had everything from test pilots to weather pilots to tow target pilots. Mm-hmm. So there was only about 1,000 women that were in that program.
Well, what was the atmosphere like? Was it very receptive to women being in that program?
Well, it was sort of, the only thing was funny was because a lot of us had instructors' ratings and pilots and the commercial ratings, mm-hmm. and we had to go learn to fly all over again the Army way, and the people that some of the instructors they got were pretty scraping the bottom of the pool, too. So sometimes it was kind of funny. We had to kind of put up with our instructors, and if we hadn't learned, but no, I would say that in most places we were very well accepted, as we got into and became ferrying pursuit planes and bombers, I think that most of the guys were as scared as we were, and it was just sort of a camaraderie about it, and except for one or two exceptions, I had very little.
Well, we ran into some prejudice down in the South, and primarily because down in the South, nice girls didn't wear slacks in public and all this kind of thing. And at one point, there were a couple of WASP who were thrown in the clink at an Army base because they were accused of being camp followers. The military police decided that they were no better than they should be. And they demanded to call their bases, and they were not given a chance. And finally, when they called their bases, and that base commander lost his job because they were, he never even checked their IDs or anything to find out whether they really were what they said they were.
Well, they never heard of women pilots. That's
mm-hmm. No, they didn't think
well, that's right. One time I was ferrying a plane through, I think it was Alabama. I was in the women's restroom, and somebody came up and gave me some money to clean the john for her before she went, and she said, well, you are the attendant, aren't you? She didn't know what my uniform was.
We didn't have very official uniforms.
But from the men, no. I think we had, in the WASPs, we were attached right to, on a military airbase in a air transport command, and each of us had a rating on what airplanes we were checked out in to fly. And we were put on a card, and they had when one was to be delivered somewhere, they picked the card at the top of the file, and if you had the qualifications, you were matched with that airplane, and they didn't know whether it was male or female, and care. And when you came back, your card went, it was all according to what you were checked out in. And first they had us faring just training planes, and then when they decided, well, let's try them on something like a DC-3, a family car of the air or something, and we did all right in that. And so then when things got tight, they decided, let's see what they do in fighter planes, and they found out that there was no difference. The women had just as good a record as the men. There was no, and I think all prejudice, it was not any, within the military, there wasn't any prejudice.
Yeah, I just saw the film Rosie the Riveter this week, and they incorporate in that film a lot of documentary footage from women joining the war effort and mm-hmm. being riveters and welding on the ship construction and so on, because it was a real labor shortage when the manpower started going to the front. And it was very positive and supportive, and some of the slogans were sort of amusing. Running an acetylene tank is no different than your kitchen stove once you get used to it, and these sort of things. These women aren't intimidated, they can do the job. And in fact, in the film, which maybe many Fairbanksons have seen because it's been shown at the Noel Wien Library, and in fact can be checked out at the Noel Wien Library, they show these women really happy to be doing really constructive work.
Oh, sure.
You guys realize it was very dull at home. All the boys had gone off to war, and there were restrictions on gasoline, and so I think it would be pretty dull to have known. And I guess that's what we all decided. We didn't want to be riveters, so we might as well
be pilots.
Well, I think Nancy was a welder.
I worked at Piper Aircraft before. And I'm just trying to remember now the sequence of what... Oh, I know. I'm trying to think when I started flying. I'd always wanted to fly. And one of the real interesting things, I think, now that you look back on it, is that when they had what they call CPT training, civil pilot training, before the war, and this was 1940.
After the war, it was
40 and 41.
Yeah, 40, 41. Mm-hmm. When they anticipated maybe needing a pool of pilots, they trained pilots under the civil pilot training program. They had two programs. All of us happened to be in it. They had a college program, non-college program. And I really searched around and left, by the way, a Southern Seminary and Junior College,
oh,
which my mother sent to me. Sent me
to
after high school.
What was it called?
Southern Seminary and Junior College, School for Young Ladies.
School for Young Ladies.
My mother tried, I always say.
My mother tried.
But, then I heard about it down there, and then I really searched for a school. This was pretty aggressive, that I look back on it, who would guarantee that I would be the woman if I went to their college.
You're talking woman.
Yeah, they had one woman and nine fellows.
One to nine. But it's really kind of amazing that even back then, they did have a quota, one woman for every nine men that they selected.
Well, that was kind of daring.
Yeah, back then it was. It was daring for me to insist to be the only woman. But it's interesting that the government, even back that far, had one woman in. One woman for every nine men.
Right. I think that was more or less a disguise to say this isn't military. This is really
it could
civilian.
Be, yeah. See, whatever it was. I got in that and got my license. And then most of us all over the country, I think many women did the same thing that I did. After you graduated from that, then you tried to get a job around an airport. Anything. Could be cleaning windshields, doing anything else you
want to
do.
Propping planes when you had to start them.
But working in the office, cool. Which is the dullest, but it was part of it. So you could take part of your pay out and flying time. And then, of course, I was building up time my flying time all the time. And then I read a Life magazine, a Look magazine, which I'd love to get a hold of, now an old one. It was a feature story on Piper Aircraft. And Piper Aircraft was looking for, they weren't trying to find help. I guess they had plenty of help. But the idea was that anybody who worked for them could fly for them for $1.12 an hour. $1.12 an hour. Oh. And so I applied for a job there and went for an interview, and I found that all over the country they came in from, swarmed in from all over the United States. They'd all seen this article, and we had interviews and see when we wanted to work, night shift, whatnot, definitely night shift, and then what we wanted to do. And I wanted to be a welder, so I was a welder for something like 40-something cents an hour. And
was that good in those days?
Oh, it's pretty good, yeah, because back there, your meals, I remember the Sunday meal, the most expensive meal at the local restaurant, four or five course was 85 cents. But,
that's 2 hours.
2 hours worth of work. What is a meal now? I mean, that same thing downtown, isn't it?
I guess so.
Yeah.
You're right.
But we had a wonderful group. As I say, people swarmed in. None of us knew each other, but the women were in a line getting jobs that they'd already been accepted for.
There were some pretty spectacular role model female pilots fairly early in the aviation industry. Where did I just read an article about some woman who had a special costume designed for her, and she was the first woman.
It was none of us.
The first woman. No, she was the first woman to fly the channel solo. Channel.
That's a long time ago.
Yeah, certainly.
Amelia Earhart, and she wasn't. Oh, the channel.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. I was thinking of.
No, it wasn't Amelia. It was someone else.
Oh, I know.
That was in.
She died in some stunt flight in New Jersey when they were.
Oh, yes. Cornelia Fort. Maybe.
No.
That was before her time.
Oh, okay.
No, she's talking way back when.
Yes.
Blanche something, I think. Actually, there was an early woman pilot up here.
Was it Blanche Noyce?
Might have been. Sister of Joe. Who was a very well-known bush pilot?
Oh, Crossan.
He was the one, Joe Cross.
Joe Cross.
His sister flew up here in Fairbanks, I think it was 1912 or something like that. Very early, pilot. And she was up here for a couple of years, and then
Not in 1912. They didn't have airplanes here until after the war.
No,
1924,
there were
25.
Bush pilots flying here when we got here. Don Wright had several.
Not before World War
I. When we got here, there were already several bush pilot women flying.
Yeah, they were. Sure.
And so then from your job at Piper, then you got in
the WASP.
Yes, I heard about the WASP, and most of us down there, all the gals, were building up times and trying to get in shape. And we go to an eye doctor to get our eyes straightened out. I'm sure they weren't as bad as he had. We'd look at these things every week. We all had appointments to be sure we passed the physical.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, we had. That's the one thing, I think, that you had to pass the same physical as the men did for the for pilot. So that eliminated a lot of women who probably made better pilots than us, and a lot of men, too,
uh-huh.
because your eyes sight was in, and your physical was very important.
Florence Weber, how did you first start flying?
Oh, well, I started during the war also. I in a way, it was indirectly. I was filling in for men. I was a geologist, and I worked for Shell Oil Company. They hired me to replace men who had gone into the service. And when I was in Houston, Texas, along with this other friend of mine, Florence Collins, she is now, we were interested in flying, and they had a demonstration in downtown Houston, and they brought several Navy planes in down on the main street, carted them in. And that sort of intrigued us, and Florence said to me, well, why don't we check in and see if we can learn to fly? And we did. We also bought the war bonds, which they were selling, but we took flying lessons as a result of that exhibit. And so we my background is entirely different than these three gals. I'm strictly what you call a Sunday pilot. And I learned...
She flew longer than we did.
Well, I got a license, I think it was in 1946. And I had a flying license before I had a driver's license, among other things, which is
really
sort of interesting. After the war, Florence and I went back to school, and then we applied for jobs here in Alaska. We continued our flying during this time, not very much, but when we finally became established up here working for the U.S. Geological Survey in Alaska, we decided we'd buy our own airplane. So we bought one, a Cessna 140. We got it from, it was Sigween and Jack Whaley, who were running the Cessna of distributorship at that time, of Ween Airlines. And we picked up our own plane. We went out to Wichita, Kansas, and picked it up at the Cessna factory there, and then flew it back to Alaska. And that plane is still flying here in Alaska.
Sure is.
I still own half interest in it.
Really?
That's
same
right.
Exact plane.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, I can still remember meeting Florence, the two Florences, in the travel service where Ginny and I were working at down on 2nd Avenue in the Empress Theater building. And this was in 1949. Now, they'd come up in 1948 to work for the PET-4 project. They were geologists with the old, that was the one that was drilling for oil up at Umiat. And I can remember two Florences came in the travel agency, and they said they wanted to talk to us. So we said, sure. And they said, do you think it would be possible for us to go out and buy an airplane and fly it up here? And we looked at them and said, sure, why not? So they did.
Was that a relatively daring thing to do? I mean, were a lot of people buying airplanes and flying to Alaska, male or female?
No.
No.
People weren't even driving up there.
It was a long way.
There's a lot of space below you when you're coming up, and there's not. It's not particularly daring. It's all if you have good weather.
Right. You said that you were both looking for a job up here. Is that because being a geologist, of course, Alaska is particularly interesting, or
we drove to Alaska in 1948 while we were going to school, and we were pretty adventuresome. We spent one summer traveling and camping in the West, and then the next year we were looking for new worlds to conquer. So the Alaska Highway, we read an article in Time magazine, and it was opened to the general public for the first time in 1948. So we had just gotten a car.
What kind of car?
Oh, it was an old Jeep station wagon, a gutless wonder.
Sure.
And we drove it to Alaska and back, and that was an adventure in itself. But
the trail pretty dusty?
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't dusty, it was muddy. I can remember. In 1951, I drove it, and it could be terrible.
Mm-hmm. Well, after we lived here for some time, we were transferred back to Washington, D.C.
How did you get on with the USGS? Were you working for them before you came?
Well, we had a friend who worked for the USGS, one of our schoolmates, and since we made the trip to Alaska, we were interested in coming back up here, and at that time, they were just starting this Navy oil lab in connection with the petroleum exploration on the North Slope, and they needed two geologists. So we applied, and since we had petroleum background, because we'd worked for Shell for 4 years, we took civil service exam and passed, and then we were hired and came up here. Drove up in a car. I can remember it was about this time of the year in 1949 when we arrived. And we bought the first aeroplane in 1950.
Uh-huh. You started to tell the story about after you got transferred, after you'd been up here several years and went back to Washington, D.C., and then you were trying to get back to Alaska.
That's right. Story. We couldn't say. We were just, they took a took us kicking and screaming back to Washington, D.C. We didn't want to live on the East Coast. But we had to write reports, which was even worse. So we schemed every possible way of getting back to Alaska, and we were trying to get together money to get an advanced degree in school. And Florence applied for a grant and got one to study sand dunes in Alaska for a degree. And we tried to think, well, how are we going to do that? Well, we're going to buy a float plane. So while we were in Washington, we bought a float plane, a Super Cub on floats, and it was in New York State on Lake Oneida. So every weekend, we would fly from Washington, D.C. up to New York State and take flying lessons. Finally, we brought the plane back down to Washington, D.C., kept it there for a couple of weeks, loaded it all up, and all our office mates were there to wave us goodbye, and we flew to Alaska on floats.
But the route you took was interesting.
Yeah, that's right. It wasn't the conventional route up the Alaska Highway, because we had to go places where float planes could land. And so we went from Washington to roughly to Cleveland, to Chicago, to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and we crossed the border at a small canoe customs station into Canada on a small lake someplace, heaven knows where it was. And then we went up past Lake Winnipeg.
Did you go through Lake Athabasca?
Yes. We went to from Winnipeg west, Lac La Ronge, waterways, and we went down the Slave River to Lake Athabasca, Fort Chippewyan, and from Fort Chippewyan.
Then you went to Yellowknife somewhere along there.
Yeah, we went to Yellowknife and then down the McKinsey. Past Fort Simpson and Norman Wells, that was closed down as an oil place at that time, more or less, to Aklavik. Inuvik was just being constructed. We flew over to Inuvik, and then we flew out to we wanted to see these things called pingos, which are ice mounds.
The geology wherever they go.
Yeah. So we went to Tuktoyaktuk on the Arctic Ocean and landed up there. Took a message to the mounted police. I think all they were doing was checking up on us to be sure we got there all right. And then we left from Aklavik and flew over the mountains up the Rat River and to over the pass at Bell. Well, we landed on a lake at the pass.
On the Bell River.
Yes, at the head of the Bell River.
That's the Bell and the Rat.
Head of the Porcupine. And we'd met a man in Aklavik, a pilot who was, and we helped him gas his conventional fixed-wing aircraft. We helped him gas his plane, and he was working for an oil exploration company. I think it was Gulf Oil. And he said, you're on floats. Why don't you stop and visit us at our camp at the pass? And sure enough, there we saw the camp, and we landed, and they welcomed us in. And turned out that the camp man who was running the camp was an old schoolmate of ours, but he wasn't there. However, they were so impressed, they gave us each a ride in a helicopter, which was our very first ride in a helicopter anywhere in a more remote place you couldn't imagine. Then we flew the rest of the way down the Bell through stopped at Old Crow. And
you visited us at Camp Denali and McKinley Park.
Well, we ended up coming down to Fort Yukon and eventually to Fairbanks.
Well, did you say you went to Barrow?
No, they didn't get the Barrow on that trip. No.
And this was after you had already met the year before, or this was...
This was 1956 that they did this.
This is the second aircraft.
This was our second aircraft.
Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing was that they went by way of by the Arctic Ocean, almost like Lindbergh's trip.
Exactly. Did you get some unusual receptions at some places that you landed, or were you just taken in stride, like this perfectly normal?
Well, they were sort of surprised to see two women arrive in a little aircraft. They called it a mosquito because they were flying much larger planes on floats.
Well, you called it the Green Hornet, didn't you?
Yeah, it was green.
How long did the trip take you?
Oh, I don't know, a couple of weeks, because we weren't in a hurry. I mean, we were trying to do it as a pleasure trip.
And they were excellent navigators, being geologists. Yeah. Mm. Don't miss a thing.
But, you know, this brings something back to me, if you'd like to hear about this. When they were back in Washington, D.C., you knew that you were going to have a place up here, or you were going to come up and do some research, and you said to look for a place to rent on Lake Minchumina. And about that time, a fellow was selling a place in Lake Minchumina that I'd heard about. Remember, Rudy Bilderberg and I wired back to you people and asked if you wanted to go in partnership with it. And I think I got a phone call or a wire back immediately. Buy it.
It was an old trapper's cabin.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember.
So it was, again, that was winter, I think, when that happened, because I didn't have a car at that time. And I called Celia, and we drove way out in Chena Hot Springs Road, 15, 20 miles or something, to find the owner, which was Rudy Bilderberg. He was an
old pilot.
And he'd been living over there for a number of years. And so we went up there and bought it. And then I remember you people left the other airplane in Alaska, so you had two airplanes at the time.
That's right.
And we had a great big, I bought the place over in Minchumina, and they hadn't even seen it. And they were arriving, and the only neighbor right next to us was Slim Carlson. Slim was in his 70s then. He was pretty old fellow, and he just died a few years ago. 75, 80, I don't know how old he was. But anyhow, he had no neighbors at all. He lived there all by himself and loved it, like a lot of the old-timers did. In the own cabin he built, and our cabin was 500 feet from it, I guess. And so I'd been out there to see the place. In fact, I'm not sure I saw it before we bought it. I don't know. Maybe I did. I think maybe somebody threw me out. Maybe Dick threw me out. At any rate, Slim got the word that, not from me, because I didn't know him at the time, that three ladies bought this place. And, oh, boy, Slim said, three ladies.
In the neighborhood.
Didn't know about it.
So neighborhood's going to dogs.
So he sent the Sears Roebuck and got himself some brand new khaki pants and the khaki shirts, what everybody was wearing at the time. And I can see him right now, leaning against this tree as the airplanes came in. You see, we had three airplanes coming in then, because you and I had an airplane.
Yeah.
I had a Cessna. And we flew in, were there three airplanes, four of us? It seems to me we had a great big fly-in.
I think so.
Maybe flew in from, and you flew your float plane, and Florence flew the old Cessna, your first purchase. And Celia and I flew an airplane in, and did you come in for this thing?
I don't remember that. Go on, I'm listening.
So I must have landed first, I think, or somewhere. All I can remember, maybe just, I think we all landed about the same time. I probably landed on the other side and had to take a boat over, because we had to landed on the airport side and had to take a boat over. And here was Slim, all spruced up man. He had a beautiful little small beard, and he was a handsome man anyhow, a Norwegian. Leaning against that tree, and just a spick and span, man, he was waiting for the three ladies to arrive who were going to be his neighbors. And it was just kind of nice. And it was a wonderful neighbor, and he enjoyed us, and we enjoyed him all summer. Have him over for dinner. He had respected our privacy, and we respected his, which meant more to him, because he lived alone all the time. He fished and trapped stuff with his dogs, but he had three. He didn't know how to take it at first.
I can imagine.
Size all of a sudden.
It's a fairly unusual
term. So anyhow, I had to interrupt Franz because that reminded me of the spot that we bought. And you still have this spot.
Yeah. Collins has lived down there now.
Yeah. We all bought it together.
I would like to tell our listening audience, those of you who have joined me late, I am in the studio with Florence Weber, Nancy Baker, Ginny Woods, and Celia Hunter, and we're discussing their experiences flying around Alaska.
Well, I think we also ought to mention that along the way, Ginny and I started Camp Denali in the Kantishna country in McKinley Park. And, of course, the Florences were welcome guests frequently at our camp. They would. We had a little airstrip there, and we also had, up until 1957, they phased out float plane landings on Wonder Lake in 1957 when the Denali Highway opened, because there was so much traffic coming into the park then compared to before. And so it...
When did you first go down to the McKinley Park area?
Well, we went down in 19... Actually, we started... Jenny and had come back from outside. She went out to get married in 1950 and came back. And her husband was a ranger at Wonder Lake, Wonder Lake in 1951. And that was when we staked out the land that later became Camp Denali.
Had you met here? You'd met your husband here in Alaska?
In fact, we met him about the first couple of days after we landed those airplanes. The weather got warm enough, and at that time they had invited all the women in town, there were many more men than women, to go skiing at what was in Ladd Field, which is now Fort Wainwright.
That would be early January of 47.
And they had a ski hill up there. So they sent in buses to get all the women that would like to come skiing, because the guys would like to please, you know, the war was over, and they'd like to see it more like a normal ski hill instead of just a military thing. And I think the first person we met was my husband, and
the second one was Gordon Herod.
And within the next 2 weeks up here, while we were waiting for the flying weather to get better, and it was just an interlude before it got real cold, but anyway, it was either too low visibility to fly or too cold. We met quite an interesting group of young people up here in Alaska who were all mostly GIs who had been in the war, and they'd come back, and they didn't, you know, they'd been left home at 18, 19-year-olds, went over and been in the thick of it. And when they got home, they were just so glad to be alive. They wanted to go see someplace different than home, and they just didn't feel at home in big universities. So the university was all these young guys that were up here, and not only the GIs, but just from, well, I would say most every young person was an ex-military person. And they were all up in Alaska, and it was the most interesting group of young people you ever could imagine. One of them that we met was John Carlson, who used to be the mayor. In fact, he had taught him to fly. I got to tell a funny story. The boys had the GI Bill, you know, and we were instructing up here along with everything else we did. We'd instruct during the nights because it was night all summer, and then we'd have another job in the daytime. So C and I had about two or three jobs between us, and none of our employees knew that we didn't just work for them. So we would trade off on jobs and do different things so that one of us always covered for the other, and no one knew, as long as the job got done, that both of us weren't working for them. But in the meantime, one of the things we did was moonlight instructing.
Original,
I mean, it was the sunlight instructing and at midnight. But anyway, John Carlson, ex-mayor, was one of her first students, and after he did very well, he was a very adept student until he got to his eighth hour when he's supposed to solo, and then he just flubbed up. And she turned around and she said, "Johnny Carlson, you're one of the best students I had. What's went wrong? Why are you, you know?" And he said, "Well, I don't want to ride around this thing alone." But that was an interesting time up here. But I think the point I wanted to make is that after I got married, my husband and I went out for a year outside to while he finished school. And most of the people we met that first year had all come to Alaska for a year, just for the ducks of it, but they wouldn't want to spend their lives up here. And it's, you know, it's all right for a year, but who'd want to live here? And when we came back the next year, there was almost everybody that we'd met that had left when we did. We're back here, and most of them are our neighbors. In fact, we've lived in one area now since 1952, and almost everybody there was a person we met up here right after the war. And now, not only we raised a family, but our kids are having kids. So there's third generation is living in the same area that we first moved to out north of the university, which is rather unusual in a place where people move around a lot.
And everyone was only going to stay a year.
Oh, that's right.
Only a year.
We just came up to look around.
Just for the adventure.
Right. And the longer they stayed away and looked at, they all decided, well, they liked it better in Alaska. But it was interesting that everybody was on their way to somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And I guess if you stop to think about it, very few people decide, I'm going to move to Alaska and spend the rest of my life.
Right. It would be a hard decision to make like that.
But there's an awful lot of people that are still here, that are still waiting to see, haven't moved yet.
I feel the same way. I just came to see, but I...
You're trapped also.
I think I'm stuck.
The reason I snagged you. Well,
the story
I wanted to say was that we started Camp Denali in 19... Well, we started building it in the fall of 51 and staked the ground and so on. And 1952 was our first summer of operation. We leaped into business within 3 days after we had driven through the park to come out and start building the place. We had our first American Plan guests. And life was like that at Camp Denali ever since then. But as I said, the Florences used to come down quite frequently. And in the meantime, Florence Rucker, Florence Weber's girlfriend, had married Dick Collins, who was the station manager at Lake Minchumina. And Florence and I had gotten into ham radio together about the mid-50s, wasn't it? We started fooling around.
I got a license in 52.
52. Well, you were ahead of me then, because I don't think I quite made it. But anyway, Florence had met somebody via ham radio, believe it or not. And
she was having trouble with the radio, and
he came over to help her
to fix it. It just didn't seem to
get first. They're just over the airways. They never even met each other.
Well, anyway, when they came to decide to get married, they thought that it might be fun to do it at Camp Denali. And so we closed camp that in 1959 with the wedding of Al and Florence Weber. And it was a fly-in wedding. Yeah. And I tell you, it was the worst weather you can imagine. But everybody got there.
How many planes do you have come in approximately? Do you remember?
Oh, I imagine half a dozen of them flew in from various...
For Plantation Field, which is only a 1,300-foot strip that you hardly would know. People camp on it because they don't know it's an airstrip.
But anyway, that was our first wedding.
I remember. Here we were going to have the wedding, and you wanted to pick blueberries. We said, hey, Florence, I think it's better time to go out and change your clothes. She had a brand new pair of jeans to get married in. And she said, well, but there's all these blueberries. Don't you think we better finish the party?
That's what I like about Alaskans. They have their priorities clear.
Oh, you bet.
All times. Where is Camp Denali in relationship to the park for the listeners who don't know where it is exactly?
Well, we were at the end of the park road at that point. On the park road was constructed about 1938, and it went from the park headquarters out past Wonder Lake down into the Kantishna. And the boundary was just about, just a little north of Wonder Lake. And when we were thinking about starting a vacation camp, I'd tried to get the use of the ranger station at Wonder Lake, but was informed by the Park Service that was off limits. And so we went outside the park and found this public domain land, which was on a ridge overlooking Moose Creek. And we flew out, I think, on the 4th of July in 1951 in the rain. It was pouring rain when we got up to the top of the hill where the camp is now. So we found this beautiful little pond, and we sat by the pond, but we didn't know whether Mount McKinley was out there or not because you couldn't see a thing. So when we did find out that you could see the mountain from up there, we claimed it with it was a T&M site, the Trade and Manufacturing Site thing of the Homestead Act, and got... you could get up to 80 acres for a business. And so we got about what we thought was 80 acres on the ridge and started building Camp Denali out there. And it, what we wanted to do was to have a place where people could come. We thought that our original idea was that everybody would come and they'd do their own cooking. You know, we'd have a housekeeping only. Well, the first guests that arrived were American Plan, and from then on we realized that we were stuck with feeding people.
What facilities did you eventually offer?
Well, guided trips, which meant that we picked people up back at the railroad at the other end of the park road, brought them out 90 miles out to our camp.
On?
Flew
them on.
No, well, we didn't try flying. Once in a while we flew people, but we were driving.
We had a plane, but we took mostly them on flights around the mountain. But the road is much more, that's where you see the wildlife and see the park.
And we wanted to do an interpretive program on the way out, too, to let people know what Alaska was like and what it was, you know, what to expect at the camp and this kind of thing, because we kept it fairly simple. We didn't try to give luxury. We gave lots of solid comfort and good food and privacy. And
so you were actually aware, even at that time, that natural resources are finite and that we need to protect them.
Yeah,
so
I'm kind of trying to figure out when we decided, when we first came up here, we thought, gee, wolf hunters were just great, that killed wolves out of airplanes. And we had none of these feelings of, but I guess the land, all of a sudden you just realize how much of Alaska is you're just never away from the environment, and you just think it's kind of a precious thing. And my gosh, every time you go outside, you think, wow, how lucky I was to get up here and see. And then you've seen the changes and how so much of it's been diluted. It's kind of nice to get up in a plane and see it in perspective, because when you start to see, where we first lived, you couldn't even get to except for the dog team, and now it's on a real main highway, and we're practically suburban. We used to be those funny people that moved way out in the woods and built their cabins out there where nobody else would ever go, and now it's in the high rent district. But anyway, I think this feeling of just how important, how precious everything is in Alaska.
And it really still seems very pristine and vast now, even with all the changes. So then it must have seemed...
Yeah. Well, everybody thought we were absolutely nuts to go out on the other end of the park road and set up facilities for tourists. They said, who is going to go out there? They just could not believe it. And, the first two or three years were pretty tough. We worked in the winter times to support the camp in the summertime because we certainly weren't making any money. We put all of our money back into it to build the cabins and that sort of thing. And eventually, though, as more and more people made their way out there, we prospered by word of mouth. We didn't do a great deal of advertising. One thing we did have, we had worked for Chuck West when we first came to Fairbanks, and he gave us a spot in his brochure. He was running West Tours at that time. Chuck West. He started West Tours originally, way back when.
When in an old building down on First Avenue where she had a type on top of the stove in the wintertime to keep. Make it warm,
you
know, warm enough.
Yes,
and then when the temperature got 20 below, we couldn't keep it warm at all, so we'd go out flying for a living until it warmed up enough for him to start up. That's how we first started, and that's how he started, too.
Yeah.
Except he got made more money.
Yes. Well, you know
he
how
kept
to make
on
money.
Going.
It's a more commercial perspective.
Well, except he got made more money.
Yes. Well, you know
he
how
kept
to make
on
money.
Going.
It's a more commercial perspective.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
Or more successful at it, I don't know.
But anyway, we really had to go from hand to mouth when we first were out there. But it was always an adventure, and we decided very early on that we were going to create as little mess as we could around where we were. And so we kept the place really tidied up, and the cabins were very neatly painted. And we always had a good cook and a good kitchen. And got quite little known for our food.
I think the most wonderful part of it was the young people that came to work for us for nothing.
Practically.
In those days.
The experience of
they
just being
well,
out there.
They just wanted to be, and then we would, you know, we'd pay their transportation expenses, and if we had anything left over at the end of the season, we'd divide it up. But I think we met some of the most marvelous kids I've ever known. Well, we were all kids together in those days, but it's hard to tell who ran the camp. But I think that, and then the guests that came were just really special people, people that were looking for something off the beaten track. And I think camp was, the repayment we got mostly was in the fantastic people that we met that came.
We still have friends all over the world that came to us through Camp Denali. Some of them staff and some of them guests.
Yes, I was just talking to someone in the hall who said that Ann Sheridan sent her love from...
Annie Shields. Well, she was a WASP buddy.
She was a WASP buddy.
Somebody here know
her? Yes, Chuck McConnell.
Chuck McConnell was
back in the Philadelphia airport, and Annie sent her best.
She phoned me last week, because she's coming up here, see?
In the spring.
Yeah, she's coming up to the 99ers are having a meeting in Anchorage.
Mm-hmm.
So
oh, that's
any of
right.
us who can put some of them up, it would be kind of nice.
Oh, yes, we ought to get them up here.
Drive down and bring some of them back.
So you all still maintain contact of at least a loose nature?
Yeah, a loose nature.
Christmas cards
You know,
and so
it's
on.
Probably not the card situation. I know what I do. I go and just visit people.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I intend to write, and I don't do it. And some of the people that I have known, well, we've had our conventions, our reunions.
The WASP has quite an organization still.
Yeah.
I've never been to one.
Mm. But I've been to a few of them, and what I do is stay over for a little while, because I figure I go so far, there's no point in coming right back. And then it boils down. Some people go home, and a few others stay over. And last time, a gal that I'd known in the WASP, not that terribly well, and I... boiled down, and we both took a trip. We rented a car and drove up to Denver, Colorado. And just had a wonderful, wonderful time. But when we get together, it seems like you just sort of fall back into where you left off. And I'm sure this is true of other people, but our organization sort of welded people together, I think.
Special times, some adventures sometimes, yeah. And probably have some good stories. We didn't even, haven't left much time to talk about your ham operating experiences, Florence. Do you maintain contact with some of your friends through the ham?
Oh, yes, of course. We've sort of fallen off the line more in these last years, but my husband and I are both very active with hamming.
Well, you got in on some of the exciting times around Alaska in the 60s,
of course,
too.
Oh, yes, of course, earthquakes and floods. And speaking of flying in connection with hamming, and speaking of the 99s, I used to belong to them for many years. I was a member, and there were some 99s were going to visit me in 1967, in August 1967. I can remember downtown, and it started raining, and pretty soon we were into the Fairbanks flood, and I never did hear whether those girls were supposed to come to Fairbanks, but I guess they never made it.
Unless they were had a float plane.
They couldn't find me anyway.
I wasn't the airport not flooded? It was the only one of the only...
The international.
Yeah.
But then getting there was...
didn't look inviting anyway.
Now, we at that time had most of the
Fairbanks Communications going through our house.
Oh, yeah.
We had a generator going in the backyard.
And relatives calling
for help. The amateurs had stations all over town, and we were sort of the control center at that time during the emergency. For about 9 days, I remember, there was no phone system, no nothing.
I think my mother called up. Got a hold of you.
Said, how's Nancy? Celia said when the official people arrived, then the communications fell apart.
When they got the civil defense going, right, then
the Red Cross and the civil defense.
Before that, everything was pretty well under control.
It wasn't only the hams. It was amazing in Fairbanks then. Everybody rescued everybody else. It was amazing people who you thought wouldn't have it in them. I remember the banker's wife, her husband had left her, and he was president of one of the major banks downtown, and she was quite what we thought of sort of the social crust of Fairbanks, and... when he left, he told her to be sure to see that the lawn was watered, and it was. But when the water got higher and higher, and I think they lived over in Hamilton Acres or whether it was,
somewhere
downtown. They had this boat. She'd never run it before, but it was he'd use it for hunting trips, so she